Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. Our guest on today's program is John Siegenthaler. You'll find his prints on much of the history of the last half century. He was an aide to Robert Kennedy as he ran his brother's presidential campaign in 1960. He went on to work for Robert Kennedy's Justice Department during the height of the Civil Rights Movement and was himself a victim of civil rights violence. He is the former editor, publisher, and CEO of the Nashville Tennessean and the founding editorial director of USA Today. He's also a former president of the Society of Newspaper Editors. He founded the Freedom Forum First Amendment Center at Vanderbilt University. Many of you will remember his son, also John Siegenthaler, who was for many years the weekend anchor for NBC News. We welcome the senior Siegenthaler to the program, and it is a privilege, sir, to have you here in our studios.
It's my privilege to be here. Thank
you. Your ears must have been burning yesterday at about this time. Calvin Trillin was a guest, and he was singing your praises.
Well, he's my old friend. I hope he was in tune.
He was very much in tune and in verse, I might also add. His new book, Dogfight, is all in verse. Yeah. Quite an undertaking. Well, we're happy to have you here. We'll be explaining a little bit exactly why you're in St. Louis, but I'd like to talk to you a little bit at the outset about the newspaper business. And you've spent so many years in it. What's your impression of the status of America's newspapers today?
Well, it's sad. Revenues are down. Circulation and advertising revenues are never going to come back to where they once were. And the sad part of that, again, is that so many qualified journalists are not working anymore, and that newsrooms have been depleted. And the result of that is that so much of what has been traditionally covered by the press in communities, both in public and private institutions, is not being covered anymore. Talking recently to a federal judge in Nashville, he says, "Well, I haven't seen a reporter in weeks," and he says it's not good for the newspapers, it's not good for readers, it's not good for the courts, and it's not good for the First Amendment.
Is anything filling the gap or coming close to filling the gap? There are so many, broadcasting, online, that seems to be where everything's going these
there
days.
There is, and there is another development that's coming along, and this judge I was talking about, we have contrived a way to sort of help fill that gap, mm-hmm. and the newspapers in Nashville, the newspaper's interested in it. At Arizona State, the Cronkite School, students there cover the state legislature for the local newspapers. Mm-hmm. Same is true at the University of Nebraska. And we're starting there in Nashville a senior seminar that's going to cover the federal courts, and the newspaper is very happy to have their work. Now, they are young, inexperienced, untrained, but I must say they are working hard at it. I can tell you that both the dean at Nebraska and Arizona State and the journalists there, professional journalists, are excited about the direction it's going. Now, that's a sad development. But it's a great opportunity for some young students who are going to be journalists.
It sounds very promising, but at the same time, I have read recently about a newspaper in Pasadena, California, and the coverage of city council meetings is being done by someone in India. They're watching the council meetings online.
and that's another, when you think about being able to Skype and go wherever you want to go and do whatever you want to do, and it's wonderful the technology can make that happen, but, you wonder, how well-briefed is that fellow in that foreign clime? How well-briefed is he on breaking events in that community? And, there's something lost in distance, but again, it is a step in a direction to fill the gap, and the gap is there.
Some copy editors are also foreign-based anymore, from what
they
I hear.
They are, and it's so easy to do that now, You can be anywhere, and the copy is in your is there in the computer for you, and you edit it, and just a stroke of the keyboard, and it's back.
What's most disturbing, I think, about this Pasadena situation, and by now that it may have changed, I don't know, but it certainly is something that people do talk about. Most disturbing is the fact that you mentioned Skype, but the inability of that person in Mumbai, for instance, to ask questions of council members if an issue arose that needed a question to be asked
about. And particularly relevant questions,
exactly.
You know. That's right. The gap is there, and it has not been completely filled. And, you know, the question, we've founders, those newspapers were flawed in their day, fallible, scandal mongering, error prone, and somehow they found the wisdom and the courage to say, better an institution that's flawed and fallible, better than that institution monitor what we're about. Because if we've got the power, we're going to punish criticism and dissent. And so they wrote those 45 words in the first Congress, and we're lucky to still be living with them.
Well, I know that one of the things that you're concerned about these days is fairness and accuracy in today's media.
Absolutely.
Is it threatened?
You know, I think when I go online and find what's there, again and again and again, it is, I think, threatened. I mean, there are so many anonymous posters who have absolute authority and indeed are protected by law. And you know, some of that stuff, if you read it, is vulgar. Some is venomous. I mean, vicious. There is no opportunity to, and no commitment to correct it. And so we're living in a world in which, as I once wrote, poison pen intellects are damaging reputations, and there is no recourse.
Well, if anyone would know about that, it would be John Siegenthaler, because you had this celebrated case involving Wikipedia. And a posting there. I'll have you tell the story, but essentially they made up a whole new person, given your background.
I was Robert Kennedy's pallbearer and knew the president well and worked in his campaign and had a great relationship with both of them. The John F. Kennedy Library Committee on Profile and Courage Awards. And so one day I got a call from a friend who said, Google yourself and hit the Wikipedia link, and I go there. And there's about a six-sentence biography that said that after the deaths of John Robert Kennedy, I was suspected of being, quote, directly involved, close quote, in their assassinations, that I defected the Soviet Union for 12 years, and that nothing was ever proved. And it was a real struggle to, one, get it down, my son said, get it down, you're not the only John Siegenthaler, you know, I'm one, and you got a grandson named Jack who's one, too, and so I got in touch with Jimmy Wales, finally, the founder of Wikipedia, and got it down. But the problem is it comes down, and he apologizes for it. And then I wrote a piece in USA Today in which I said, this makes it unreliable if if somebody's going to research a personality to do an essay, a feature story, or to do a classroom assignment. And the result is you go online, there's an actor named Sinbad. His real name's David Atkins. David Atkins has been killed 250 times on Wikipedia. He's died from a drive-by shooting, a suicide, sexual assault in a public bathroom. Again, most often they just insert, after his birth date, a death date. And, you know, here's a fella whose presence is important to his profession, and it just went on and on and on. And in my case, you know, after once Jimmy Wales acknowledged and took it down, and he did readily, and after I wrote this article criticizing Wikipedia, it came up and down, up and down, up and down. And
then the same thing,
and then worse. And I think they finally put a block on it after I was accused of raping Jacqueline Kennedy.
Oh, God.
So, you know, it is everything that you can imagine.
You never, of course, found out who was doing this.
I found out the fellow who had that six-sentence biography of me. I had a lot of help from an awful lot of people, some of whom had been similarly defamed. And one fellow in San Antonio, Texas, helped me track the Internet protocol number the poster, and the result of that was that I was able, with the help of some colleagues in journalism, Kit Seeley from the New York Times, a couple of people from USA Today, a reporter from the Associated Press, all began to focus on it, and sure enough, finally, the fellow came in one day and left a letter apologizing, and I had a rather hot conversation with him about it. Said he did it. It was a joke, and apologized. It's hard to believe, he knows I don't believe it, but it happened. You know,
how do we protect ourselves against this sort of thing?
You know, we're very vulnerable to it, and there really is no protection. There's no protection really at law. And because so much of it is anonymous. I mean, I could, and I intend to maybe. Tonight, at First Amendment Celebration, I intend to sort of raise a couple of three of those issues where people have suffered and had no recourse. And ultimately, if enough politicians get burned by that, I mean, you know, free press could be endangered, could be threatened, and that bothers me deeply. You know, George Washington felt the barbs of the anti-federalist press in his day, and he called them infamous scribblers. When I was writing that piece for USA Today, I was tempted to pick up Washington's line about infamous scribblers. I decided to call them poison pen intellects instead. But throughout history, you know, since Gutenberg, governments have wanted to regulate every new development in technology. And the danger is if you go to the government to regulate, they overregulate. Mm-hmm. And the courts have twice struck down efforts by Congress to protect children from obscene matters. Now, you know, they're moving now with with cyber-stalking and cyber-bullying, and they're moving in the right direction on that, but infamous scribblers are still at work online, and people are suffering from it.
You know, I love the word scribblers in this context because it is so demeaning to the scribbler.
That's exactly right.
John Siegenthaler is our guest. He will be speaking tonight at the First Amendment Celebration Fundraiser, sponsored by the St. Louis Journalism Review for the Gateway Journalism Review. It's taking place at the Edward Jones headquarters on Manchester Road. It gets underway at 6 o'clock, and you'll hear much more from John Siegenthaler if you attend. And if you would like to, you can get more information on our website at stlpublicradio.org. We'll be back to continue our conversation here in the studio, and of course we'd like to bring you in on it. If you'd like to chat with John Siegenthaler, do so at 382-8255. That has a 314 area code for our new friends in Quincy and Hannibal. You can send us an email at talk@stlpublicradio.org. We'll take a tweet at STL on air, or you can reach us through Facebook. We'll be back in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. And welcome back to our conversation with John Siegenthaler. If I read the resume again, John, you wouldn't have any time for questions. But folks, I'm sure, know your reputation as a newspaper man, as a former political confidant of the Kennedys, and a man who is very much interested in First Amendment protections. And you'll be talking about that tonight. I'll give more information about your appearance tonight. Back to the conversation that we interrupted with that break. I'm involved with an organization here, that focuses on media literacy. And the idea is to examine what you read and what you hear very, very closely to determine, in fact, if it's accurate. But, you know, what you've just described with Wikipedia and some of the other things that are going there online, I'm not sure that it's possible to ever use that critical thinking to determine accuracy.
No, you know, if I had to say where the answer might lie, I would suggest that it's going to require an acknowledgement by citizens, not by politicians or government. It's going to take action and an exercise of the First Amendment rights to be discriminating online, to pick and choose where you go and where you give your support. I know from having received that overwhelming response after I had the problem with Wikipedia that there are thousands and thousands of people out there who've been hurt by. And it's not just Wikipedia. It is all over the Internet. And there's so much wonderful information out there for you. It's a wonder world. And still there are these poison pen intellects who will hurt and who will damage and do so anonymously. And it is so tough. And unless citizens decide that they're going to act and they're just not going to go there, and they're not going to respond to it. I would have to say as I watch online blog, websites of newspapers and television stations, they will allow an awful lot to go up there in those letters columns that's offensive. And they would never publish it in the newspaper. Right. But they will put it up on that line and say, well, I hope we get some response to it. I hope there's some people who come up there and there are an awful lot of hits there. And that demeans the system, to tell you the truth. And it worries me and offends me. It's about the only time I really wish I were back in the business.
Yeah, they all encourage this interactive notion where you want to bring people in, because the more people you have coming to your website, the more successful the website.
That's right, and the more likelihood that ultimately you're gonna get to pull up some advertisers on that website.
That's where it's going.
That's where it's going. Ultimately. That's where it's going.
When somebody figures out how to really make money on the web,
that's exactly right. There in the new technology, there is a need for traditional values of accuracy and balance and depth. And, traditional newspapers, traditional broadcast stations haven't been perfect in pursuing those values. On the other hand, there has always been, in my lifetime, there's always been a commitment to those principles. And there is no commitment to those principles online.
Yeah, as everybody tries to figure out what's going on and how to respond. Let's bring in a caller. Ben is calling from South County, and he wants to talk about Wikipedia, I believe. Ben, come on in. Take your time. Ask your question of John Siegenthaler.
Okay. Hi. It's kind of a comment more than a question. But excuse me. Wikipedia's unreliability and susceptibility to vandals is precisely why teachers will never take it as a source. I was a student recently. The most I could ever use it for as a jumping off point. If it has a lot of internal citations to external sites, to other more reliable sites or external links, I could follow those, and then use that. But the site itself is more of a fun thing to browse than a reliable information source, I find.
Ben, thank you so much. That is true. It's a jumping off place.
I agree completely.
Better than
completely.
A principal source.
And that's right.
Yeah, yeah. Could you start a USA Today?
At the time Al Newhart had the idea and made the commitment, there were real doubts. And once it hit the streets, sharp criticism. I mean, it was judged to be news in brief. Now, the stories were never shorter than some television radio news stories. On the other hand, the criticisms after a time began to die, and, it's turned into be quite a successful enterprise. And
America's newspaper. A lot of people are calling it America's newspaper.
We called it the nation's newspaper after we were in Washington and Baltimore. It was a little marketing device, but we knew where we were going, and we knew the technology would work. You knew you could bounce those pages off the satellite. The question was, could you maintain and sustain the viability of color, which was so important to the founders of USA Today.
As I remember, the whole concept was kind of like make it like television, and even the vending machines were like a television.
If you look at those machines, they were devised that way for that very purpose. Mm-hmm. It was, and you know, it was a newspaper that was designed for people who were on the move, and for many people, it became a second read. You know, everybody was reading the hometown newspaper, And, you know, we had great responses from people who were on the road, traveling, needed to catch up, needed to get briefs of the news, and it was there. Now, you know, today they've all got iPads or Kindles or to take with them, and USA Today feels a little sting from that.
Well, it was a brilliant strategy to have them delivered free to every hotel room
Absolutely.
In the country.
And on every airplane, you know.
Yeah. No, that was a great strategy. Yeah. How is it doing today?
It's doing pretty well. It was the number one in circulation. It's fallen behind the Wall Street Journal in the last 3-4 years. But, you know, it's still there, and it's a 5-day-week publication. And it's like every other newspaper. They've had the same hits on staff and the same hits on resources. So It's always a struggle, I think, in print news media today. But I would have to say the response to it continues to be very strong, and there is a very strong online site where you can go for USA Today.
Well, and now very soon we'll go for Newsweek, because Newsweek, the printed edition, is biting the dust.
That's right. Yeah. When John Meacham left, my heart dropped, because I thought that was the editor. He was a fine editor, and it was, to me, a signal that Newsweek was in deep trouble.
You're not a fan of Tina Brown?
Well, you know, I know Harry. I know her husband quite well, Harold Evans. He's a good friend. I think she's innovative and creative and has done some good things, you know. But she's done some things to keep it alive. I have some respect for her.
But, you know, this is my observation. It's almost kind of a dumbing down kind of thing, that what they're doing is it's style rather than substance. It's gossip. It's celebrity news, that sort of thing.
That's right. And I think that's the difference between John Meacham and Tina Brown.
Yeah. All right. But she's going to sell a lot of ads online.
There's no doubt about it.
And probably will. I'd like to backtrack in this conversation. There are so many things that we could talk about, but I'm particularly interested in your time with the Kennedys and particularly that 1960 campaign. John Kennedy, a Catholic, running for president at that time, and people thought that that was going to be a tremendous obstacle. What are your best memories of that time?
Well, just speaking of the issue of his Catholicism, I remember well the meeting with the Houston Ministerial Alliance in a hotel ballroom packed with Protestant ministers, some of them not all that friendly, some of them friendly, but the questions. His speech that night, I thought, put to rest for most people the whole issue of Catholicism, you know, the fear expressed by many of those ministers that night was that that the Pope, that Kennedy would be subservient to the Pope, and that the Roman Curia would dictate U.S. policy, and you know, that stuff had been dead since Al Smith had run for president, but suddenly it emerged. And I thought Jack's appearance at that ministerial alliance made the difference in the campaign, really. I thought that at any point after that, it had a tremendous television audience that night. And that's one moment that I thought made a great difference. Second moment that made a difference was the call to Coretta King when Martin King was imprisoned on a trumped-up charge. It was controversial to make that call. Sergeant Shriver talked to then-Senator Kennedy about it, and together they made that call. And lo and behold, within a few days, Daddy King, Martin King's father, distinguished Atlanta pastor, endorsed Kennedy, and I thought it made a major difference in the campaign.
Having just gone through the campaign we did, I'm sure you make mental comparisons from time to time about the way they're run today and the way they were run then.
Well, they do, and I'm not sure that Mitt Romney's advisors would not have done well to subject him to a meeting of religious critics because of his Mormonism. I think it was not raised during the campaign as it was during the Kennedy campaign, and I think that's a very positive step. Nonetheless, I think there was an undercurrent that I don't know that it was creating hostility for him, but I think that among some conservative Christians, it deterred their enthusiasm and really came to hurt him some. And I had hoped that he would talk about it, and I think it would have gone away. I think it would have built enthusiasm on his side. The other, the other religious issue during that campaign was whether, again, you're going to have to have Obama's former pastor brought back into it. It was just a moment when there was a flicker of that, but it didn't have traction and it passed. And the big question from my perspective is the whole flow of money as a result of the Citizens United case. And at some point, sooner or later, we're going to have to come to grips with money in politics and deal with it in a way. Supreme Court says money is speech, and you can't argue with that. I mean, it is. But there doesn't have to be anonymity with all those contributions, and people who put that money up should be willing to stand behind it, and maybe the law should say they have to stand behind.
Well, there's a chance, I suppose, that it could die of its own weight, given the lack of success that all those dollars brought to the people who made these donations.
I would think so, I think there's some real wisdom there. I mean, you think of this fellow who said, "Whatever it takes, I'm going to give it to Mitt Romney for this campaign," and then you look at the popular vote, and then look at the Electoral College vote, and it didn't help. And I think part of that probably is that those people who gave that money to put those negative television ads on, they probably had some voice in directing where the money was going to go, what the ads were going to say, and it was not very effective. It turned out it was not effective at all. I thought during the campaign it was having an impact, but on election night it didn't. I would just say, in addition to that, there is one aspect of election night that I'd just like to comment on briefly, because as one who was born and raised in the South, it was haunting. On the Ole Miss campus and the campus at Hampton City, Sydney that night, there were outbreaks of meetings in which racist comments were the order of the day. And it embarrassed, I know, the administrations of those institutions. They've had to apologize for it. There have been some investigations on campus of who was involved with it. But it reminds you again that 50 years after the movement and more, we still haven't been able to put this terrible stigma of racism behind us. And that's another aspect. As Romney's religion, Obama's race, did not play a major role in this campaign, but that outburst after his election is bothersome and should be of concern to us all.
It's done a little differently today. It's done in code.
It is. And, that's right.
Yeah, it's right. It's there, but it's not quite.
That's right.
Visible.
And it's only when there's an explosion like that, in which it's overt and beyond the code, and when it, you listen to it and you suddenly say, "Oh my, are we back there?" Next day there are apologies and there are policies put in place. We're gonna have classroom diversity. We're gonna change this. So, you know, but having it come up in that way really, for me, was very disturbing.
Well, there was an apology to you for the first Wikipedia incident
and
that they kept coming.
That's right. That's exactly right.
Let's take a call from Gabriel calling from St. Louis. Gabriel, thanks for waiting. You're on the air.
Yes, hi. Your experience with Wikipedia and, you know, the recent deluge of, you know, other generally unwanted speech, you might call it. For example, you know, so many calls to personal phones during the presidential campaign brought a perverse sort of idea about freedom of speech to mind. We have freedom of speech. We have protections in that area. How about some protection from freedom of speech, i.e., and obviously I'm very much in favor of freedom of speech, and it's a great thing. But when you explicitly do not want to be reached, i.e. by political campaigns, and, you know, the pollution that happened regarding your Wikipedia entry, et cetera, there should be possibly an idea about freedom from speech, particularly as all this speech somewhat occludes the beauty of the freedoms we have in speech. You know, if you're constantly getting calls of a political nature when you don't want them and you sometimes even tell them not to reach you and you can't really protect yourself from it because politicians, for instance, are allowed to have dispensation from those restrictions, which they wrote into these laws themselves.
Okay.
I just wonder about that.
Well, I understand your feelings about it, and it's a sentiment that's widespread. A couple of days ago, the Post-Dispatch had an article on the Supreme Court failing to provide the sort of support you're talking about, although the law is, as it was applied, sort of out of context. But let me just talk about it for a moment. Police officers have maintained the right to be free from scrutiny from citizens. There was a law passed in 1960 which said you may not record a person without person's knowledge. And some people have recorded police officers on traffic accidents. Famous case in California where a motorist was taken from his car, and we can all remember the tragic scenes.
Rodney King.
Yeah, Rodney King was beaten. And the court said, you know, you in this recent refusal to take on the case, effectively said, you know, we're not going to go there. We're not going to uphold that law that gives you freedom from speech if you're a law enforcement officer. Now, what about it if you're an ordinary citizen and that call reflects an attitude I think that's widespread? Legally, it seems to me it's a slippery slope. And so I certainly wouldn't want to get into the business again. Congress opportunity to, I just as soon not have John Boehner and Nancy Pelosi and Harry Reid and Mitch McConnell deciding what's fair, what's accurate. I'd like to keep it as far away from Congress as I could, frankly.
I'm not sure they're capable of deciding anything.
No, and I certainly don't think. I know that most of them would have the same instinct as the caller to say we would like to be free from. Yeah. We'd like to be free, but you know you can't create a zipper and pull it over the society and escape the reality of a traditional media or the exploding new media.
You can't cherry pick either.
No,
you can't say this is good
right.
and this is not good.
That's right.
It's all essentially.
But I must
thing.
Say there, are, I know so many people who would say exactly what the caller said. It's a widespread feeling.
Right. That's John Siegenthaler. He's our guest today, a noted journalist. He's in town for the First Amendment Celebration fundraiser sponsored by the St. Louis Journalism Review for the Gateway Journalism Review, taking place at the Edward Jones headquarters on Manchester at 6 o'clock this evening. We have more information about that on our website at STL Public Radio On Air. Back in just a moment, and we'll take more of your calls. We have some lines open. The number is 314-382-8255. That's 382-TALK. You can also send us an email at talk@stlpublicradio.org. We'll take a tweet at STL On Air. You can reach us also through Facebook. Back with John Siegenthaler in just a moment. This is St. Louis On the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again, and welcome back to our conversation with John Siegenthaler, in town for that event tonight, sponsored by the St. Louis Journalism Review, a fundraiser for the Gateway Journalism Review. I have a number here. There are some places available if you'd like to attend. The number is 991-1699, 314-991-1699. I'm sure we'll put that on our website, and I'll give it one more time before the end of this program. John, I wanted to, as I said, so many things to talk about. I wanted to get to the whole Freedom Writer experience. Calvin Trillin, you and he were involved in that whole episode together. We have a number of people in St. Louis and have done programs on it who participated in the Freedom Rides. But I'm particularly interested in the incident in which you may have almost lost your life. What happened?
Well, the Attorney General and the President after the Freedom Riders were stopped and assaulted one Sunday afternoon at Anniston Inn in Birmingham and were insisting on continuing a ride and were incarcerated, the President Attorney General sent me down to try to get the governor of Alabama to provide support and to try to get John Patterson was the governor, to try to get Bull Connor, the police chief in Birmingham, cool, to support and give them protection. And it was a hard, tough assignment, but I talked to both of them, and ultimately the governor, through his safety commissioner, Floyd Mann, said, yes, I can. He said, yes, I can protect them. And he tried to protect them. The police commissioner in Montgomery, Alabama, pledged to support as well, but I must say that the moment we got there, it was a teeming anthill of violence, that bus station parking lot. I've never seen anything like it. Not just grown men, women and children screaming racist invective, tops of their, and it was people going mad. And the Freedom Riders came off the bus. They were immediately assaulted. I was in a car. There were some young women, maybe a half dozen young women, most of them black, two of them white. They went to a taxi cab, black driver. He said, I just can't take those white women. They'll put me in jail. They'll take my license away. And one of the young black students said, move over. A beautiful woman said, move over, I'll drive. He said, no, 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 no. Anyway, these two young women, after the cab went off, started walking. And as they hit the sidewalk, I was coming down the street in the car. And they were being beaten. And it was a chance to get out and help them. And I got out. And I'd never been knocked unconscious before. But the result of it was I didn't get them into the car. I did get knocked unconscious. I was out for 25 minutes, and finally, police, 25 minutes later, arrived. And I spent some time in the hospital and came out of it. And Robert Kennedy called me on the phone and said, how's my popularity down there? I said, don't run for anything in Alabama. You got no shot. But it was a very serious moment for all of us and for the country. It was a shocking event, but I would have to say I've made lifetime friends as a result of it. The young students who were on that ride, many of them are close friends of mine. All these years later, I sat down with John Lewis, the congressman from Atlanta, just last week, and at dinner, and we reminisced and thought it over. And 50 years after the event, I finally had a chance to sit down with a young woman. I tried to help, a young woman named Susan Wilbur. And for the first time, we recounted what had happened, each of us from a different perspective. I had only seen her through the windshield of a car. She was bleeding from the nose and mouth and was being punched. And I thought it was going to be so easy to get these two young women out of here. Bounced up on the curb, leaped out of the car, to the rescue. Well,
Didn't work out.
It was a policeman who finally took me to the hospital.
Well, for what it's worth to you, and I'm sure it's worth something, Calvin Trillin said yesterday it was one of the most heroic acts that he had ever seen.
Well, he's my friend. It was, and I have to tell you honestly, it was instinct more than anything else. It was not an act of calculated courage. The instinct was that I can get them out of here without any trouble at all.
But it was an instinct that was inbred in you somehow, because you went to the Nashville, Tennessee, and you had what's described as a lily-white staff.
I did.
And you did something about that as well.
I did, and I think that, I think look back on that time, and I really was fortunate to escape the racist trap that captured so many of kids in my generation. And parents are part of that, education part of that, but somehow I escaped a trap of racism that captured too many of my friends.
We still have a ways to go, don't we?
We have a long way to go. Yeah. That's right.
I have an email here. It reads, I'm a pastor in St. Louis and met you a few times last year as I traveled with a good friend of mine to Freedom Rider events. She was a white woman Freedom Rider on the Anniston bus, Genevieve Hughes, a Cornell University grad who left Wall Street for civil rights work with CORE. Genevieve died last month. She so appreciated your advocacy for their safety in Alabama and your honesty and insights in the PBS Freedom Riders documentary, and I thank you.
She was a wonderful woman, Genevieve. Yeah. I knew her casually. We would see them every time the Freedom Riders would gather. She'd be there. And, here was a great, courageous young woman who just on her own decided, I'm going to help this cause and I'm going to risk my life. One of the things that stands out in my mind as I think back on that, on the night before the Freedom, those kids left for Alabama, they knew what the danger was. Their mentors, some of them, were trying to keep them from going. They all sat down and wrote last wills and testaments that night. And when I think back on John Lewis and his colleagues taking that step, I'm still in awe of where their courage came from.
And think back also on Bull Connor, whom you mentioned a moment ago. He was certainly capable and proved that in many famous instances where he put the dogs on people.
There's something to be said about a fellow whose name is Eugene and prefers to be called Bull. I mean, you're exactly right.
Well, it's not a nickname you'd like if you're a newspaper man.
No, it's not at all. That's right.
Let's take another call. Paul is joining us from St. Louis. Go ahead, Paul. Paul, are you there?
Carl's here.
Okay, go ahead. I'm sorry. I had the wrong name. Go ahead, Carl.
Okay, Carl from St. Louis. Great to be part of this discussion. I've written in a few opinions on editorials in the Post-Dispatch. A few of them were published, and a couple of them were actually edited, and I didn't think that was quite right. If they're going to edit it, please don't put it in if you're going to edit it, because those are my words, and if they edit it, I think that takes away part of that. Your opinions on that, if you would.
Did they change the context of what you had said? Or
they did not change the context so much, but one word can change it. One edited word can change it, in my opinion. If you're going, and they were brief comments and fairly innocuous, and I thought that that was wrong. If you're going to print it as such. If not, don't print it.
Had you signed your name and were?
I did.
Yeah.
I did. Sure, I did.
Well, my own rule was that we publish letters with names, and if there is a question that's to be raised, you have to make contact with the letter writer or not run the letter. And if you're going to change it, you have to call and talk it through and get permission. Now, every editor has maybe a different standard, but that was mine.
Right. Right. Okay. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much for the call. We have an email here from Jerry. Regarding the racist component of the recent election, is it any surprise that if you compare a map of pre-Civil War slave states and the states that supported Mitt Romney, that they are nearly identical?
They're all blue.
Yeah.
They're all blue. It's as if you put the map of the South over the blue states, the Confederate states over the blue states. And there's a commentary there that really speaks for itself.
One of your big issues is, of course, the First Amendment. We've alluded to that a couple of times during our discussion here. What are your concerns? Do you feel that the First Amendment is threatened, challenged?
You know, when I retired from the newsroom and started the First Amendment Center at Van Bly. I made a speech, and in it I said, and this is a direct quote, my grandson would say, Gran, you've gotten old enough where you're quoting yourself instead of Thomas Jefferson on the First Amendment now. But I said that in our society, free expression was never safe, never secure, but always in the process of being made safe and secure. Since Gutenberg, we've had efforts by government to regulate every time there has been a new technology, and inevitably it's going to emerge in this new era of information explosion. And I'm very nervous whenever Congress decides it's going to put its hands or its voice or its head to the business of regulating speech. On the other hand, abusive speech is there. And I would hope that there would be a citizen reaction and almost a citizen revolt. I mean, people should use their First Amendment right to speak out against the violence, the verbal violence that exists in too many cases online today. And that pretty much sums up my philosophy of it.
There are so many things going on that don't involve, quote, speech directly. And I'm thinking of some of the things that we see on YouTube. Most specifically, I'm thinking of that video that has caused so much trouble, the anti-Muslim video that triggered so much violence in the Middle East. How does that fall under this banner, this umbrella?
Well, you know, I have absolutely no doubt it's protected. The problem, I think, is that information service providers like Wikipedia or like YouTube really disclaim any control over what shows up there. I mean, Jimmy Wales, I said to him the day I called him about what had happened to me, who did it? I got no idea. You know, you can file a lawsuit and the court might tell your tell the information service provider who's providing that person with service who it was. But the information service provider turned out to be Bell South. They were governed by the Privacy Act, couldn't under the law. So unless I filed a lawsuit, I couldn't find out who that anonymous poster was. And beyond that, some people, just give you one example. Fuzzy Zeller, Frank Urban Zeller.
Golfer.
A golfer, winner of the Masters and the U.S. Open. Fuzzy Zeller was described on Wikipedia as a drug addict, an alcoholic, a wife beater, and a sexual abuser of children. He filed suit, had the IP number, traced it to a company in Miami, and they said, Mr. Zeller, we admire you. We don't know anything about it. Come on in. They interviewed every employee. There may have been a visitor who walked in off the street and used their computer. Fuzzy ultimately dropped the suit, couldn't find out who it was. And that has happened again and again and again. The anonymity, and clearly there's a First Amendment right to anonymity. I mean, the pamphleteers were virtually anonymous, you know. We know as a result of history who most of them were, but it is a conundrum as you think about what's going on. And what bothers me is that there is so little negative reaction to it. And that's, I guess if there's any message I'd like to bring, it is, come on, folks, this is your amendment too. And if you don't do something about it, you're going to lose it. Alexander Hamilton was not a big supporter of the First Amendment. In Federalist 84, he says these words, whatever fine phrases are inserted into a constitution, it's altogether going to depend on public opinion. His words, public opinion and the general spirit of the people and the government. And he's saying there, yeah, you may get it, but you better not forget You can have it taken away. And that's a lesson we all should remember.
And that's where we're going to have to leave it with John Siegenthaler. He's in town tonight for a fundraiser at the Edward Jones headquarters on Manchester at 6 o'clock. More information on that on our website, stlpublicradio.org. You can also call Charles Klotzer at 991-1699 for more information if you'd like to attend. There are some seats available. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. What a great interview.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Great to be with you.
Join Steve Potter tomorrow for Cityscape, and he'll talk with jazz guitarist and vocalist John Pizzarelli about the Songbird Cafe and the Luminary Arts Center's new exhibition, Social Security. Monday on this program, the Nine Network's Jim Kircher will be here to talk with David Nassau about his book on Joseph Kennedy. Archive versions of past St. Louis on the Air programs available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org. Our thanks to Mary Edwards, Alex Hoyer, Aaron Dorr, Ariana Tobin, and Robert Peterson for their help in this program. St. Louis on the Air, a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thanks for listening. I'm Don Marsh.